This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Italian food is now popular around the world. My guest John Mariani points out that it wasn't long ago that Italian food just about everywhere outside of Italy was regarded as little more than macaroni with red sauce, chicken parmigiana, pizza, and cheap wine. Before World War II, only a handful of major cities around the world had any Italian restaurants at all. Mariani is the author of the new book, How Italian Food Conquered the World, which is in part about how immigrants to America created the Italian-American style of cooking that became so popular. Mariani is also the author of America Eats Out and the Dictionary of American Food and Drink. He's the food and travel correspondent for Esquire magazine and a wine columnist for Bloomberg News. John Mariani, welcome to Fresh Air. The Italian food that really caught on first in America, you point out it wasn't really Italian food, it was more Italian-American food. So what was the food that first caught on?
Well, it was clearly the immigrants from the southern part of Italy. 85% of the immigrants who came to the United States between 1880 and 1920, 5 million of them, 85% were from the south, Naples, Sicily, Abruzzo, where my people came from, Campania. And these were very, very poor people who, believe me, had never been to nor owned a restaurant nor probably so much as a grocery store. And back in the old country, they were spending 75% of their income on food, and that was a meager income. And when they got to the United States, they found they were spending only 25% of their income, and there was food available every day. Out of this came the so-called Italian-American cooking, which was based very much on Italian products, but they weren't the same as Italian products over there because they just couldn't get them at that point. They did ship in their own cans of tomatoes. Curiously enough, the tomato came from America and went to Italy. But this kind of cuisine started out with pizza and a little pasta and some Italian salads, and it was only within the Italian communities in the United States, mostly New York, Boston, Providence, some in New Orleans. The Sicilians went to New Orleans. And it grew in popularity because it was a very lovable, comforting, and at that point very inexpensive cuisine. So that after World War II, when the Italians were starving again until their recovery kicked in, the rest of the world started to catch on to Italian-American food rather than the regional foods of Italy, which were very, very different from one another. So that a Tuscan was not eating the food that a Sicilian was eating, and a Sicilian was not eating the food that somebody from Rome was eating. They were very different, 20 different regions with distinct cuisines. So it took Italian-American cuisine to actually conquer the world.
So getting back to Italian-American cuisine, so we're talking pizza, pasta, marinara sauce. This was based on home cooking. It wasn't really based on restaurant cooking because, as you pointed out, the Italian-Americans who were first selling this kind of food in restaurants and pizza places didn't likely ever go to a restaurant in Italy.
The only likelihood that they had ever been to something facsimile of a restaurant would have been a pizzeria, because those did begin in Naples after 1860. And the pizza margherita, as we know it, which is the typical, prototypical tomato, mozzarella, and basil, was actually concocted on a specific week in 1881 when the queen consort of the new Italy came to Naples. And there was a competition among the pizza makers, and he put together, very cannily, a pizza that had the colors of the new Italian flag: red tomato, white mozzarella, green basil. So the Italians in Naples, well, let's say the Neapolitans at least, had familiarity with pizza because that was a street food, that was a snack food, and they might have had an extra couple of lira to spend.
Can I interrupt you for a second? So this was named after Queen Margaret, who was making the visit?
Yes, yes, Margherita. So when those people came to America, one of the first things that appears in New York that is completely identifiable is the pizzeria, which in 1905, the first one, it's still there, opened on Spring Street in Greenwich Village. It's called G. Lombardi's. And then they proliferated, and then there were the Italian grocery stores where you can get an Italian sandwich. But it grew and grew in popularity throughout the 1920s and 30s. It was cheap food, just as Jewish American food was cheap food, Chinese American food was cheap food. And it got its foothold early on. Also, as I said, 5 million of those Italians came over, so that's a lot of Italians to spread the word.
So if Italian restaurants early on in the history of Italian-American food in the U.S. were based more on home cooking than on what restaurant cooking was in Italy, how similar was what you'd eat in a restaurant to what an Italian family would actually eat at home? Because, like, if you went to an Italian restaurant back then, you'd probably get a really big plate of pasta and then probably a fairly big portion of meat, maybe a big dessert. I mean, Italian food, when I was growing up, was always seen in my neighborhood as very fattening food. Now Italian food is considered really healthy, Mediterranean cuisine, but, you know, the cheeses and the pastas and the big desserts were not seen as healthy food.
Well, they weren't seen by most people as healthy food because they probably ate too much of it at those very little restaurants and trattorias. At home, as you say, that's where it was all taking place because the abundance of American ingredients in every market changed radically the position of the Italian woman, especially the Southern Italian woman. Because back in the old country, her job was solely to get some food on the table, whatever it was. And in the North, it was almost every single day, three times a day, polenta. In the South, they might get pasta just a couple of times a week, a few vegetables. When the immigrants came to the United States, they could afford to buy pretty much anything they wanted, so that the shift of the Italian housewife went from just getting food on the table at a subsistence level to becoming the best cook on the block. And part of that was the abundance. Part of that was that we can have 10 meatballs if we want. We can have a pizza that's 12 inches across rather than 6 inches across. And this was translated into the restaurants, as you said, too much food, too much sauce, too much abundance, which Americans, being big eaters, just dove into for so many years. And it was not particularly healthy food, and it was not particularly the best of ingredients necessarily either. It was only in the 1990s that the so-called Mediterranean diet came along, which I detail in my book, where the whole food pyramid that we all learned about in high school was just upended, so that the proteins were now at the tip top, meaning the smallest amount you should eat, and the beans and the grains and the pastas and the olive oils were all on the broad bottom, which is what most of what we should eat. That was a very big departure from how Italian food was viewed before that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Mariani, who writes about food, has written several books about food. His new book is called How Italian Food Conquered the World. Now, you talk about how after World War II, when, you know, processed food and canned food became really popular, when there was all this, like, new food technology, that Chef Boyardee became, like, a really famous brand. And you tell the story of Chef Boyardee. I'd like you to tell the story.
Well, he was an Italian immigrant, grew up in the Midwest, and had some restaurants. And during World War II, because pasta, in those days spaghetti, was such a cheap dish, and canning was the only way to get American GIs and servicemen fed, that he made a small fortune in the ration business during World War II. This also allowed those hundreds and hundreds of thousands of GIs and Air Force kids and Navy kids to get a taste of Italian food that kids who didn't grow up in the eastern cities probably had never really tasted before. So after the war, he marketed it, and very, very successfully sold millions upon millions of cans. And I remember asking my mother for it growing up in the 1950s. And, of course, she arched an eye and says, well, if you must. And I remember tasting it for the first time. It was just this overcooked canned spaghetti in this sweet tomato sauce. And I was just appalled at how bad it was. But that very night that I tried it for the first time, there were millions of American kids eating that thing. Still do.
Yeah. And also, I think, like, in the 50s and 60s, dishes like chicken cacciatore were really popular. It's funny the way Italian food has gone in and out of fashion. Like, do you see chicken cacciatore on a lot of menus now?
You do now, and you see, I've been seeing more eggplant parmigiano, eggplant parm, if you will, on some of the toniest of Italian restaurants, and it's really, really good. And the reason it's really, really good is that in the past it was made with the cheapest possible ingredients. By the past, I mean before the 1970s and early 80s. Italian cooks and chefs had absolutely no access to what we now take for granted, which is to say extra virgin olive oil, Nobody ever heard of extra virgin olive oil. Nobody outside of the city of Modena, where it was used as a Christmas gift, was balsamic vinegar known to anybody. Funghi porcini, true prosciutto, which was kept out by the pork producers of America for so long, Parmigiano Reggiano, all of these things, and of course the ultra-expensive white truffles, these were ingredients that were not available in any way, shape, or form to Italian cooks, however expensive their restaurants were. So they had to use white mushrooms instead of funghi porcini, and they had to use poor quality olive oil. And no imported pasta. So they were at a disadvantage to really show off how delicious the food could be.
So how did olive oil become a staple, not only of Italian cooking, but of cooking?
Well, you're absolutely right about that. The French, who once completely eschewed olive oil, unless they were in the deep south of France along the Riviera, if you open the typical French cookbook in the 1980s, you would barely see olive oil mentioned at all. Today, pick up a French cookbook, and I would say that at least 60-70% of the recipes are using olive oil. And this happened again.
And sometimes instead of butter, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you speak to a chef like Alain Ducasse, Roger Verger, all of these famous French chefs, and they extol the virtues of olive oil for its taste, not for its health benefits. But what really happened with olive oil that made it so fashionable was that the International Olive Oil Commission in the 1980s was one of the major promoters and funders of that Mediterranean diet idea. And it coincided with the so-called slow foods movement, which grew very rapidly out of Turin, that artisanal products and smaller producers make the best food, which seems very logical to most Europeans. But to the rest of the world, or at least to Americans, we didn't know about that. We really didn't know. Most Americans' idea of Parmesan cheese was out of that little green canister that Kraft Foods made. So olive oil now... you can't go into any supermarket anywhere without finding half a dozen olive oils, and they're all extra virgin olive oil.
Now, there's a lot of American chefs who aren't Italian but who love Italian food and who either specialize in it or serve it as part of their menu. Do you think Americans who aren't Italian-American have changed Italian food?
Yeah, the most salient example of that is a guy named Michael White. He's this big, luggy Wisconsin, Midwestern kid who fell in love with cooking and told his mother and father, I want to go to Italy to study food. And of course, this is more than 10 years ago, they said, you've got to be crazy. Well, he did, and he learned the right way, and he came back, and by working at some of the finest Italian restaurants in New York and Chicago, like Spiaggia in Chicago and San Domenico in New York, he learned this refined Italian cuisine. And he's opened a series of restaurants, which I now consider among the best Italian restaurants in the United States, one of which is Marea. Marea, M-A-R-E-A, is on Central Park South. And there, like Paul Bortolotta in Las Vegas, he is doing a kind of seafood, Italian seafood, which you will only find on the Italian Riviera, made as well as he does. Now, the interesting thing is, being not an Italian-American, but an American kid, he puts his spin on everything. So his latest restaurant is called I Fiori, but there's a lot of French and global techniques in there. So he's not so staid as many Italian restaurants in the old country are staid and never get out of their comfort zone. Guys like Michael White are not only leading the charge, but believe me, those are the chefs that the Japanese and the people in New Delhi and the people in Shanghai are all looking to and often hiring to come over and either consult on their restaurants or to open a restaurant, a Michael White restaurant in Shanghai or New Delhi. Just as some years ago, Wolfgang Puck, who pioneered the so-called gourmet pizza, now has outposts all over the world.
He's not Italian, right?
No, he's an Austrian kid. He's an Austrian-born Southern California chef. He came there in the 70s, cooked strictly Nouvelle French cuisine. And then when he opened Spago, because he didn't have much money, he said, well, I just want this to be a really good pizzeria, but I want it to be the kind of pizzas that you could get in Naples rather than the Italian-American, or at least the American pizzas, And in addition, he struck really gold when he came up with the so-called Jewish pizza, which was with smoked salmon, caviar, and sour cream on top.
I have to say, those kinds of pizzas make no sense to me. I think I'm kind of a traditionalist in that respect, but
me too.
I don't understand like pineapple on pizza and things like that. Can you explain it?
Well, that is very typically American corporate, which is to say that Wolfgang Puck comes along or Alice Waters up at Chez Panisse, and they make a few interesting pizzas that go a little beyond the outside of the usual circle, and they add ingredients that are unusual, but that's their interpretation. What happens then is something like California Pizza Kitchen gets hold of it and says, let's have 35 different pizzas. Let's put anything we want. Let's put barbecued chicken on top. Let's, as you say, call it a Hawaiian pizza and put pineapple. And I think at a certain point, a pizza stops being a pizza, or at least stops being a good pizza or anything like a good pizza.
You give some recipes in your book, and one of the recipes is for marinara sauce. What's your favorite recipe for a simple to make marinara?
This will be my easiest and quickest answer. You take you take a pot, you put in 3 or 4 cloves of garlic, brown them in olive oil, take them out, pour in a can of tomatoes, which have been peeled, cook that for about 20 minutes to 30 minutes, mush them up if you like, salt, pepper, a couple of sprigs of basil, and that's it. I mean, many times people, there's a story in the book that I tell, and it's it was going to be the subtitle of the book called Stretching the Sauce, and my mother, who is a very good cook, I brought 5 or 6 friends home from college, just walked in the door and said, hi, Mom, and she would finish dinner, and she said, oh, sit down, I'll make you something. And I said, well, no, don't go any trouble. And she said, no, I'll just stretch the sauce. Well, that sauce only took 20 minutes to make. And for her, it was, again, to show off her prowess as a wonderful Italian-American chef. But that is what a marinara sauce is. And curiously enough, you won't even find the name marinara in the Oxford Companion to Italian Food. It's not something they use in Italy. This was an Italian-American word creation for the so-called red sauce that there's an interesting quote in the book from Martin Scorsese about how the red sauce, the marinara sauce, became a religion. And on Sundays, every Italian housewife, sometimes grandma, was either making a very, very long-cooked meat sauce, which could take 3-4 hours or more, or the marinara sauce, which took 15-20 minutes.
Mm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, your grandparents your grandmothers were both from Italy?
Yeah, my mother's side of the family was from Campania, south of Naples, and my father's side was from Abruzzo, which is east of Rome, in a little Adriatic town called Vasto, which I've seen pictures of in 1905 when they came over. You would have emigrated too. Now it's a quite a fashionable resort for the Germans and the Austrians who just come right down the coast. But it was not a nice place to be back then. It was poverty stricken, as all of these southern Italian towns were. There's a quote in the book from Booker T. Washington, a former slave who became one of America's great educators, and he wrote a book called "The Man Fathers Down." And he visits Italy, this is in the 1880s, 1890s, and he saw 12-year-old children, 10-year-old children working in coal mines. And he said, the American Negro of the South is not the man farthest down. I have seen the man farthest down and who were much worse off than the American Negro. These were people who had to get out of, how to get out of town. And one of the great options was America.
So sometimes I ask musicians to redeem a song, to take a song they love, but that other people think of as square or corny or sentimental, and they're often criticized for loving this song. I'm going to ask you to redeem a food, to take a food that is mighty unpopular, but you think is really quite good.
I think, and I'm seeing more of it, that tripe, which is cow's stomach, and it has to be cleaned by the butcher, and it's snowy white and looks like a bathing cap. And it can be very, very chewy. But when it is stewed in the Italian manner with tomatoes and onions and chili peppers and Parmigiano cheese, it is one of the best dishes in the world. And I'm seeing it more and more and more on menus, and I couldn't be happier.
Do a lot of butchers sell it?
No, it's you really have to go to a specialty butcher. You're not going to find tripe in the A&P.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, John Mariani, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great, great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
John Mariani is the author of How Italian Food Conquered the World. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Mariani is also the food and travel correspondent for Esquire magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brazilian percussionist Ciro Baptista has played with everyone from Paul Simon to Herbie Hancock to Yo-Yo Ma. On his new CD, Baptista and his band interpret the music of composer and saxophonist John Zorn. Music critic Milo Miles has a review of Chaim on Zorn's label Zotic.
Back in the heyday of world music fusions in the 1980s, tradition-minded players and fans worried that too much mixing of styles would result in a dreaded generic world beat that was a bit of everything and a lot of nothing. The neo-traditionalist movements that countered runaway fusions were worthy attempts to keep old styles alive in specific regions and languages. And eventually the idea of huge crossover hits in world music faded away. But the ideal of blending diverse styles never went away. And one of the most enduring proponents is percussionist and bandleader Ciro Baptista. He's from Brazil, but his real native land is the recording studio and on stage. Baptista is a regular collaborator with John Zorn. And like Zorn, you never quite know what his records are going to sound like. Indeed, Chaim, Baptista's latest project with his group Banquet of the Spirits, uses a dozen themes written by Zorn as starting points. But all the tracks take off in unpredictable, though satisfying, directions. On the first cuts, Baptista and Banquet of the Spirits evoke and play around with the sounds and textures of North African Gnawa music, and even the horn-driven clamor of Morocco's Djajouka musicians. But just when you think Chaim is settling into a pan-Middle East mode, the album swerves into a delightful evocation of Indonesian gamelan. Most impressive is that all this variety comes from just a quartet. Producer and arranger Shanir Ezra Blumenkrantz plays oud and the Gimbri African lute as well as bass. Tim Kuiper does drums and percussion as well as the Ngoni guitar from Mali. and Brian Marcella excels on piano, harpsichord, and pump organ. Dieter Baptista plays a slew of instruments that throb and rattle, including some of his own invention. Everybody does some affable chanting from time to time. But more than virtuosity, it's the harmonious, positive spirit of Chaim that makes it a fine introduction to Baptista's way of performing. The session ends with a number called Felig, featuring Marcella wailing on the pump organ and a workout that's both witty and eerie, a sort of Phantom of the International Opera. The strong group unity and interaction helps Chaim avoid the typical downfalls of eclectic world music albums. Fancy, empty playing, and superficial dabs of exotic styles. Instead, you feel like you're listening to a captivating travelogue told by a group of nomads who are at home everywhere.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed Chaim on the Zodic label. My guest, Canadian physician Kevin Patterson, has witnessed the spread of diabetes in the Arctic and on islands in the South Pacific. He attributes this to obesity caused by an increasing reliance on processed foods and increasingly sedentary lifestyles as traditional lifestyles disappear. Patterson lives in British Columbia on Salt Spring Island, but for the past 16 years, he spent part of each year practicing medicine in the Arctic along the Hudson Bay. His novel Consumption is based on his experiences in the Arctic. He's also treated soldiers in Afghanistan, working as an internist and intensive care doctor at the Canadian Combat Surgical Hospital in Kandahar. He co-edited Outside the Wire, The War in Afghanistan in the Words of Its Participants, which was published in 2008. Kevin Patterson, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start with an image that made a big impression on me. You write about how when you were a doctor in Afghanistan at the Canadian Combat Surgical Hospital in Kandahar, that you treated Afghan soldiers, police, and civilians, and that the insides of their bodies were really different from the bodies you were used to seeing in Canada and in the Arctic. Would you describe the differences?
The typical Afghan civilians and soldiers would have been 140 pounds or so as adults. And when we operated on them, you know, what we were aware of so dramatically was almost the absence of any fat or adipose tissue, or just trace amounts around underneath the skin. But when we operated on Americans or Canadians or Europeans, what was normal was to have most of the organs encased in fat. And this is an observation that has been made many times in lots of different places other than war, but it had a kind of visceral, if you'll forgive the pun, potency to it when you could see it directly there.
You know, I have to say, I think often about how a body looks when it's fat from the outside. I've never really thought, you know, not being a doctor or not seeing surgeries, I've never really thought about how it looks different inside. So you actually see fat inside, surrounding organs.
Yeah, absolutely. And more importantly, the visceral fat, the fat that in the abdomen that encases the organs, is very metabolically active and is part of what has driven the epidemic of diabetes over the last 40 years in the developed world. And what's driven it, of course, is this rise in obesity, especially accumulation of abdominal fat. That fat, as I said earlier, is metabolically and endocrinologically active. It induces changes in the receptors that cells have to insulin. Basically, it makes them numb to the effect of insulin. And for a long time, the body can compensate for that by secreting larger amounts than normal of insulin in an effort to keep the blood sugar levels normal. But over time, that numbness becomes too profound to be overcome by higher than normal insulin levels. And then the pancreas begins to fail and can't secrete as much insulin as it had been. And this is when we develop diabetes.
After reading your article about working in Afghanistan, I got the impression you were surprised that you never had to give insulin to Afghans.
Yeah, that's true. I do a lot of critical care here in Canada, and this is normal when people are very sick and stressed by infections or extensive surgery. We often have to give insulin even to non-diabetics in order to keep their blood sugar something like normal. When the blood sugar gets too high, it impairs the body's ability to fight off infection. Among the Afghans who were critically ill, this was never necessary. And again, it has to do with the fact that they were, you know, their body fat percentages were a third or a quarter of what North Americans typically are. Presently, you know, about a quarter or 30% of North Americans are obese. And this representation rises quickly as people get older, which is the people who make up most of our patients in a North American intensive care unit. So this is a very common, almost normal problem for us.
I don't want anyone to think that we're holding up the people from Afghanistan as models of health. The average age of death in Afghanistan is 39.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. There's an idea called the epidemiologic transition that describes how people get sick as a function of where their society is historically and culturally. And it begins with this idea of a hunter-gatherer society, and that's stage one. The Inuit, with whom I work in the Canadian Arctic, lived like that certainly until the late 1960s. Their principal problems were starvation and predation and other situations. That changes in the Middle East with the Mesopotamian civilizations and the advent of agriculture. And then people are still have fairly precarious lifespans in terms of average age being about 35, 40. But their principal problem becomes infectious diseases from the crowding. Starvation's still an issue. Stage three happens with the Industrial Revolution, where really there's enough to eat, but industrial problems, malignancies, pollution start to bear on it. Stage four is with the advent of antibiotics, and so North Americans went through that in the 50s and 60s, and that's when life expectancy starts to take off. Viewed on this idea, the Afghans are pretty clearly still in stage two, where they've got a subsistence agriculture existence. And their life expectancy reflects what other cultures have had in living that existence.
Now, you work part-time in the Arctic, treating Inuit people, Native people. Your novel consumption is about a doctor in the Arctic. I imagine some of it is based on what you experienced and observed. The doctor in your novel comments on how the diseases and injuries he treats changed since the time he arrived there, and he says, "I don't see the head injuries and the dog maulings that I used to. Now they all waddle in to see me, and together we talk about how we might control our diabetes better." So what changed as the diabetes level increased? What's behind it?
Acculturation, the traditional Inuit culture of relentless motion and a traditional diet consisting mostly of caribou, but also Arctic char and whale and seal, that's been abandoned over this period of time for Kentucky Fried Chicken and processed food and living a life very similar to ours, spending an awful lot of it in front of a glowing screen.
So whale is very fatty food. I mean, whale, it's blubber, it's whale fat, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between whale fat and, fried chicken or french fries?
Well, I think the big thing is that your body will forgive you for eating almost anything if you move enough. And if the way you get your whale is by being out on a boat in the ocean, working very, very hard to stick a harpoon in a beluga whale, then you won't get large. The other thing, too, is that historically, carbohydrates were almost not a part of the Inuit diet. They'd get some when they ate the berries that were available for a few weeks in the fall, and that would be about it. now our diet is so full of simple carbohydrates that that they're not adapted to, and we're not adapted to either. And that's one of the big drivers of the rise of obesity worldwide.
You've written about how much cheaper it is in the Arctic to eat processed food than it is to eat fresh food, in part because fresh food has to be shipped in a refrigerated truck or train or whatever, plane, in order to get there. And that's pretty expensive compared to what, like processed food that can be packaged and you could take a long time to ship it and it'd still be edible.
Yeah, it's all flown in. There's no roads or rail access to any of those communities.
Oh.
So a 4-liter jug of milk can cost you $10 or $11. But you know, this, and part of the point in my writing has been to draw the parallels between the experience of the Inuit and the southern North Americans. There's a very clear parallel between that and the inner city, in poor neighborhoods in North American cities. Fresh food, healthy food, is either not available or extremely expensive compared to, on a calorie per calorie basis, compared to fast food available on every street corner. And so something about the way we've structured the economics of food privileges the least healthy food available to us. You know, we subsidize the high fructose corn syrup products and make fresh beans and broccoli much more expensive, again, on a calorie-per-calorie basis.
Are there fast food restaurants in the tundra now?
It's amazing to think about it, but yeah, there are. There are fried chicken outlets and burger joints in Rankin Inlet, the little community I work in mostly, and they're just stacked. The people love that food.
Hmm. So what do you do when you're in the Arctic, when you're working there, and you don't want to have a fast food, high fructose corn syrup, lots of fat kind of diet?
It's really difficult, you know. The fresh food and milk is all flown in and is very, very expensive. And so it's easy to understand why people eat so much of the highly processed packaged food. But really the answer for the Inuit, I think, is to preserve some of that hunting tradition and continue to eat caribou and fish. There's a public health effort to do just that. They call it country food, and there's an effort to make Arctic char and caribou available to families where there aren't hunters, and to encourage those hunters who are still active to attempt to harvest as much food as they can for the community. It's difficult, though, because salty, sweet food appeals to the human palate, and people crave it for reasons that have to do with the food that we're designed to crave going back 50,000 years.
The rise of diabetes in the Canadian Arctic must be a very expensive prospect for the Canadian healthcare system, especially if more and more people need dialysis.
Absolutely. The fact is that no country in the world has the resources to continue to treat diabetics the way that they're being treated now if the prevalence rates increase at the rate that they're increasing for much longer. I worked in Saipan, which is in the Marianas Islands in the Western Pacific. It's an American possession. And there, the dialysis population was increasing at about 18% a year, all as a consequence of diabetes and acculturation, exactly the same process that's going on with the Inuit. You know, when you look at the curves, it's just clear how unsustainable it is. In 20 or 30 years, everybody on that little island will either be a dialysis patient or a dialysis nurse, unless something fundamental is done about the rise in diabetes. And so change will be forced upon us. It's going to happen. It would be nice to do it in a considered fashion earlier rather than waiting for the crisis that's coming our way. And that's no less true in Canada and no less true in Samoa and Hawaii and even in Omaha and Toronto. You know, we all have exactly the same problem when we plot out those curves.
Dr. Patterson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Kevin Patterson practices medicine in British Columbia and the Arctic. His novel Consumption is based on his experiences in the Arctic. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. We're broke. That's an expression we've been hearing a lot lately, including from legislators, mayors, and governors. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about what that homey expression conveys.
The word economics comes from oikos, the Greek word for home, and originally referred to the art of household management. It hasn't meant that for some centuries, of course, but people are still drawn to describing the affairs of government in homey terms. Take "we're broke," which Republicans have made their mantra to justify cuts in government programs and services, none so insistently as John Boehner, who has been pleading the B-word for years, long before the B-word was cool. That claim that "we're broke" drives some people into a lather. A recent New York Times editorial called it obfuscating nonsense. No states are going to go bankrupt, it said, and a country with a big deficit is no more broke than a family with a college loan. E.J. Dionne called it a phony metaphor. And a recent Bloomberg article observed that you can't call a country broke when investors all over the world are lining up to lend it money for less than a 1% return. In response, though, a spokesman for Boehner said that a family is broke if they keep spending more than they're making. And who's to say that sort of definition is wrong? It isn't as if broke is a precise term like insolvent. And Republicans aren't the only ones who have found the word a handy label for government deficits. The New York Times editorial qualms haven't deterred the paper from running headlines like "California almost broke." And even Jon Stewart said not long ago that the country is broke, though he laid the blame on the extension of the Bush tax cuts. On the other hand, if the definition of broke is so loose, why go there in the first place? The Times called the word a scare tactic. And broke can raise specters of bailiffs and breadlines, and seems to come up a lot in the scenarios of imminent financial catastrophe in ads for vendors of gold coins and bullion. But broke can convey things other than fear. It comes from an old use of break to mean impoverish, and suggests an abiding association between destitution and destruction, the same connection that gives us wiped out and busted, not to mention the rupt of bankrupt, which came from the Italian for broken bank. The Victorians said all to smash, or more politely, ruined, which could suggest financial, moral, or social degradation, or sometimes all three together, as when a character in Thackeray's Vanity Fair says, "A countess living at an inn is a ruined woman." In fact, broke in its synonyms can convey those same overtones of shame and disgrace, which is why we say somebody who's gone broke is financially embarrassed. You can be born poor, but nobody's born broke. It's a calamity that happens to you through ill fortune or improvidence. But one way or the other, broke implies helplessness. As Ray Charles put it in "I'm Busted, There Ain't a Thing I Can Do." It brings to mind the little Monopoly man on the bankruptcy chance card, with his pockets turned out and his palms and shoulders raised in a plaintive shrug. That's what can make "we're broke" a self-absolving way of closing down a discussion, whether it comes from a parent or politician. What part of "we're broke" do you not understand? Well, okay, since I asked, it's the first part, actually. I get where "broke" is going, but I have some trouble with that "we." In my experience, people work more sleight of hand with that little pronoun than with any other word in the American political lexicon. Who exactly is the "we" on whom all that helplessness and humiliation have been visited? Well, who could it be but the American people, or the people of New Jersey, Wisconsin, or wherever? But if that's right, the statement's puzzling. It isn't as if the whole country is beggared or the American economy has collapsed. There's still a lot of money around in the aggregate, even if it's not spread around evenly, and there are places where the floorboards show through. That's where the pronoun gets tricky. "We" doesn't always mean you and I and the others. Thanks to the semantic operation called metonymy, the word can jump from one thing to something else that's connected with it. When I say "we're parked out back," I don't mean me and my wife, I mean our car. And when the president of the pep club shakes the tin where the cookie money's kept and says, "we're almost broke," she doesn't mean the members are all out of money, just the club's coffers. And that's pretty much what John Boehner and Jon Stewart mean when they say "we're broke." Call it stealth metonymy. We're not broke, no more than "we're parked out back." It's just the cookie fund. And that isn't the helpless, mortifying kind of broke that can descend on a family with nowhere to turn. We can either get some people to kick in a few more bucks, or we can spend the rest of the school year eating saltines. But whether it's the PEP club or the federal government, that's a question of politics, not household management. And while you could describe the situation by saying, we're broke, that doesn't really move the conversation along very much. The problems with the pronoun, things would just be clearer if we were left out of it.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can find links to all the clips and articles he referred to on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
Bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went by, and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.